We've been studying the self in its various forms through the lens of the Parinirvana Sutra. So to start today, I thought I'd just read something about the self from our Soto Zen tradition, from Keizan Zenji, in the Transmission of Light, our Japanese Soto co-founder Keizan, actually talks quite a bit about this true self. He says it like this. This is on the 40th ancestor, Gong-an. Keizan says, "When you see it fully, you will know without a doubt that there is an I. You will know that there is a self. If you want to know this realm, when you toss out dualistic ideas of right and wrong, good and bad for the moment, and don't depend on anything or anyone, this very mind itself shines naturally with a brightness brighter than the sun and moon. Its purity is purer than frost and snow. You will not be able to say that it exists because it's empty and clear, like space. You will not be able to say that it's non-existent because it's bright and keenly aware. It can't be discriminated with body, speech, or mind, nor discerned with dualistic mind, conceptualization, or perception." And yet, we can say it can be recognized and appreciated and lived. That's the true self. We've also been talking about the conventionally true self. We could say this I that Keizan's talking about is the ultimately true self. Then there's the conventionally true self of the causal series of body and mind experiences that we conveniently name I, me. And then there's the false self. That's the illusion of an experiencer of the causal series in addition to the causal series. So, as a review, here's a little math quiz about these three types of self. First of all, speaking of the conventional self, the conventionally appearing self, the causal series of body and mind experiences, approximately how many of these selves would you say there are in the human realm?
Yes. 7 billion.
About 7 billion, yeah. About 7 billion conventional selves. About 7 billion causal series in the human realm. And, really here we're talking about six realms of sentient beings. So there's a lot more than 7 billion conventional selves, because all the animals have selves, not to mention the gods and the hell beings and the hungry ghosts and so on. So in the realm of humans, how many false selves would you say there are? Yes.
6.999 billion.
Any other guesses?
Countless.
Countless.
Yes. I mean, could you answer it differently? 100%.
Well, I'm talking about the false self of the experiencer. How many experiencers are there in the human realm?
Couldn't you say that 100% of humans have that experience at some point?
Or none?
Yes! That's the answer I was looking for. Zero.
Oh, come on, Sue.
There's zero false selves in the realm.
That's what we've been learning from.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's true that maybe when we say there's 7 billion, we'd say there's 7 billion illusions of a false self.
7 dreams.
What's that?
7 billion dreams.
Yeah, 7 billion dreams of a false self. But how many actual false selves are there? Zero. And how many in the realm of these sentient beings, how many true selves are there?
One.
One. I think that's, you know, looking at it in terms of math is interesting, right? There's about 7 billion conventional human selves. There's about zero false selves. In fact, exactly zero. There's not even one actual false self. And there's one in the realm of, if we have to talk in numbers, one true self. We don't say there's zero, that like Kazan says, we don't say it's non-existent. And we don't say there's 7 billion different ones. In fact, that's one of the, my understanding, one of the types of self, of true self, that the non-Buddhist philosophers were sometimes spoke of in India as a kind of experiencer. A true experiencer. It's not our ego self, but it's like a, it's like our essence of the doer and experiencer. But each person has their own. Then there would be 7 billion true selves. And I think in this sutra is saying, it even says at one point there's only one Buddha nature. Each person doesn't have their own Buddha nature or true self. We share it. And that's a slightly different understanding than some,
more than slightly.
Yeah, a little more than slightly. Yeah. And this issue of faults, you could say, it the fact that there's zero, another way to kind of point at that is if we're talking about like a mirage of a lake, you could say, how many lakes are there in that mirage? There's no lakes. But there is one mirage of a lake, right? And so there are many illusions of the separate self, but there isn't really any. So, and I think we talked about already to a nice sort of shorthand version, I think works pretty well, is to call the conventional self experiences. The longer version is it's the causal series of body and mind experiences. But well, that's what we mean by experiences. Experiences are always happening to body and mind. They're nowhere other than that. And they're always happening in this causal series. So just for sure, experiences, any experience we're having, maybe let's take out we're having, any experience that we can experience is the conventional self of the moment. This experience we're having right now of seeing and hearing and feeling a body is our conventional self. And then the experiencer of that, to feel, think and feel as if there's an experiencer of this experience, that's the subtle illusion of some entity called the experiencer, the false self. And the true self, we could say, is like the experiencing of all the experiences. A little bit different. Experiencing is not an experience. It's process. It's another name for awareness. Awareness, not some dualistic consciousness that comes and goes, but the spacious, space-like. Awareness with no boundaries, in which all experiences are happening. If we call that experiencing, we can't get a hold of it. It's similar to experience, but a little different. And that's how I think this true self is similar to the conventional self, but a little different. As we explore this, we can come to see more and more the illusion of the separate self, the experiencer, and clarify that classes are good for this, right? And discussions are good for this. We clarify it conceptually more and more. I think it's so helpful. That's why the Buddha spoke in words and all these sutras were recorded. Clarify the teaching conceptually, and our mind becomes more and more convinced that we can't find an experiencer. But that's just part of the process, a necessary, maybe beginning part of the process. And then there's like bringing that understanding into our life. And that's the like endless, difficult challenge. Somewhere I read that Suzuki Roshi said something like, and I can't remember exactly what it was about, but it was some kind of insight into, it might have been about this issue of the self, or about, you know, existence of things versus emptiness. It was some classic Buddhist insight teaching. And he said, you can understand this teaching, let's just say it's about no separate self. You can understand it conceptually very clearly, and you can become completely convinced. And that's like splitting a rock in two. You can take a chisel and just hit it, and it splits really cleanly in two halves. Some rocks, maybe there's no dust or anything, it's just a really clean cut. In other words, I can really see this is the false self and this is just the causal series. There's no gray area once conceptually, like splitting a rock. But then he said, in the realm of our actual experience, especially emotionally, and in the realm of feeling, it's like splitting a lotus stem. And if you take a chisel horizontally to a lotus stem and cut it, and then it's like, it's not a nice, neat split. It's like all these strings. The lotus stem has all this, what do you call it? Fibers. And you can like, you're hacking at it with a chisel and biting at it and ripping at it. And it's like slowly stretching apart in a super messy way. I thought that's a great analogy. So in a class like this, we can, yeah, I really see it. It's a nice clean cut. But when we bring it into our lives and somebody insults us, for example, we say, I know that's not, that experiencer that feels so offended and wronged by this accusation is, and all this tension in the body. I know it doesn't make sense, but I really feel like it does. So the realm of feeling, I think, is a long process of integrating this understanding and applying it. We could say applying it or remembering it in our actual lived life. It's much messier, like in the field, when we leave the laboratory, something like that. But I think it is the same. We can catch more and more. We're convinced in a conceptual way, and even in zazen, we can bring it into our simple, more easygoing experience. In zazen, we can feel like there's somebody here who's like getting annoyed and how long the zazen period is, and why doesn't the Doan ring the bell, and the separate self's coming up there, but it's not so strong sometimes in zazen. We can just say, that's it. There's just an experience of annoyance here. What if it's just, we just leave it as a dependently arising experience and don't add in that experiencer? Okay. We can like use that insight and just like to release the illusion of the separate one. And so it's nice to start in zazen and then bring it into, I think, the most difficult realm is human relationships. That's That's like the lotus stem work. Yes.
So sometimes, or maybe often, if you're stuck in that being offended, and you can't clear it, then reapproaching it where there's space and calmer, maybe in Zazen. Just going back. So what's that reapproaching?
I think it's just that we're in a calmer space. So say we have like some argument, we get really triggered, we're really abiding in the illusion of separate self, and we know it, the symptoms, you could say, of this hidden view of the separate self, the symptoms or the signs are suffering, a bodily tension and aversion and grasping and all that good stuff. And so therefore we know that it was activated, and then we calm down later, we're okay, and then we're like, let's go back and look at that now. Let's reflect on the same, maybe, argument. That person's gone now, but can reflect. I really feel not so good about that. Let's go back and look. We can say, yeah, I can identify that separate self. And what is it that wants to go back and look? Is that what you're asking?
Well, that actually goes back and
look. Yeah, that goes back. You could say it's the causal series. Yeah, I don't think it's usually the separate self. I think it's the causal series, and especially part of what's woven into the causal series is all our aspirations and intentions to practice the way. So you could say bodhicitta, the aspiration to realize awakening for the benefit of all beings, is... They talk about actually conventional bodhicitta is like the wish to do this work and go back and look. And then in the teachings there's also ultimate bodhicitta. Bodhicitta means awakening mind or awakened mind. Ultimate bodhicitta would be like the true self. And you could say that's also, you could speak of it like that, the true self's calling us into itself, to realize itself. Our true nature is saying, remember me, I'm who you are, and if you remember me, you will be totally fine. And it's like, it's a voice, you know, in the background. Our true nature calling us. It is who we are, it's never not there, as the sutra says. But it's masked, it's covered by our illusion of separate self. And but it's trying to poke through. It's like the light in the basket, and the basket's getting these little holes where the light's coming through. And what makes the little holes? Discussions like this. Mm-hmm. And Zazen and all this.
In a way though, the experience happened. I was thinking that maybe we're reifying the experience, going back, approaching it as something real.
Yeah, could be that actually maybe all three cells are involved in this going back. That there's a little bit of like, that was so painful for me, and I, the separate self, don't want to feel that pain again. So I, the separate self, want to work this out. I, the separate self, I'm going to practice the way. I think that's true too. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think we could say that, is that I think the true bodhicitta doesn't involve the separate self, but our, sometimes our striving in practice is based on the separate self. But the nice thing about Dharma practice is that even if the separate self is involved, it's like a practice is, if we bring the separate self into practice, it's like a self-destructive mechanism sort of kind of built in, right? Like this tape will self-destruct in 30 seconds. It's like you bring the self into the practice and it can't withstand. The deeper we go into the practice, the less it can stand and eventually be seen through. Did you have a point?
I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but I like your answer. And Thomas Sarov Bhikkhu talks about something about the necessity of desire. I'm not sure that's the word he's using.
Intention is important.
He's talking about what he calls fabrications, the fourth skanda. And the necessity for fabrications, but as you proceed along the path, kind of like you just said, ultimately the final fabrications that you use in your mind to analyze what's going on, ultimately the final one basically self-destructs.
Mm-hmm. We could also say it like, mainly what we're working with in practice is the causal series, conventional self, that gets us to the Zendo, that decides what kind of practice we're doing, that decides to study the sutra. All that's like the conventional self, but maybe mixed in with the false self sometimes too. But that's the kind of gaining idea. Personal gain in practice is like the false self. But then, yeah, the more we use the conventional self, especially the fourth skanda, I think that's exactly right. Intention, chetana, is one of the main factors in the fourth skanda. So it's like part of the causal series is deciding to practice, and then the more, deeper and deeper we go, the more the whole thing can unravel.
We're so used to saying, I do this, or I do that, or, but it makes just as much sense, like you're saying, to say, it's our intentions or it's our aspirations, but you could also say that it's a function of intelligence, it's a function of wisdom.
Yeah, Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just leave it at that.
Yeah. Here's another note.
You can leave the self out of it entirely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're all related, and what seems like the conventional self eventually becomes revealed as a true self. Here's a kind of a retreat note that I wrote at one point. I usually refers to the body as in these phrases like, I'm really aching, or I'm in pain, or please don't hit me. And phrases like that refer to me as the body, right? Or I refers to feelings like I'm sad or I'm angry. Or I refers to the perceiver like I see, I hear, and I taste. Or I refers to the thinker, I think. Or I refers to the individual consciousness that can say, I know, or I'm aware. If we trace any of these experiencers or experiences back to the experiencing of them, we find our true unchanging self of timeless awareness, which can manifest as any of these limited selves, thereby seemingly obscuring itself or seemingly hiding itself. So we can start with these false selves, right? I am the body and I'm in pain, right? And we can trace that back to like, what is it that's experiencing that that body of pain? And we find it's just the awareness. So we can start from the limited self, tracing it back to the knowing, the experiencing, which is the same for any limited self, it's the same for any skanda, any grasped skanda. What is it that's experiencing this skanda, and then we find our true unchanging self.
There is that phrase in the Tibetan Buddhism of when the snake completely uncoils, then that pain evaporates.
Yeah, the snake of like our kind of tangled self is like seems to be knotted up, but the snake can untangle itself.
Yeah.
It can unravel itself. It does without somebody going in there and doing it. Just by being aware, it can unravel, and then it's free of that knotted tangle.
They use the phrase completely experiencing.
Completely experiencing. Yeah, it's just the slightest shift. I collected some notes from some of these longer retreats, where really like considering these types of teachings. Here's some thoughts. Sometimes these thoughts would be like, I'd be sitting a lot of zazen, and like the light would start to come through, and like after zazen, I just have to pull out a pen and just like try to capture. So it's a little like, you know, fingers trying to point at something from experience. So this thought is that the shift from the self or identity as limited dualistic consciousness residing in the head or in the body to the self or identity as boundless, unlocated, non-dual awareness. Do we understand the shift that we're talking about? The shift from the I think particularly here we could say the false self to the ultimately true self. This shift doesn't have to be such a major change or shift of perspective. A hair's breadth difference is as the distance between heaven and earth. Everyone is already naturally or innately on the kind of on the right track by feeling and thinking that I is related to consciousness. We often identify with our dualistic consciousness, the fifth skanda, as ourself. The Buddha kind of observed that. Sometimes we identify with the body, but or the whole package of five skandhas. But if we have to single one out, people often feel like, really, I really feel like I am my consciousness that's knowing different things. We're on the right track by feeling and thinking that. Even though the Buddha said, consciousness is not myself. We just need to carefully examine our own experience, which is rarely done. By asking, is awareness present? We first discover awareness as ordinary dualistic consciousness. I think that's what happens first. Is awareness present? Yes, awareness is present, and often I might speak about that as we've just discovered like our true nature, but I think usually what we find is our ordinary dualistic consciousness. Yes, that's present. Which maybe even appears to reside behind the eyes and ears and the head in some location, for example. But then we can investigate, what is it that's aware of this sense of location, and does this awareness of location have a location itself? When we come to experientially know that all experience happens in boundless, timeless, unlocated awareness, we can feel our sense of self or our sense of identity naturally shift from the limited, located self residing in the body to the unlimited one in which the experience of the body appears. It's almost like a choice to make this shift. Almost like a choice. But once the two versions of self are clearly discerned, we can clearly see the difference between the limited, located sense of self and the boundless, all-encompassing self. We can maybe even shift back and forth between our identity being one or the other, and see what the difference is. Right? Once this, these two versions of self are clearly discerned, then the shift from the limited one to the unlimited one is a very natural one, like happily stepping across a threshold. The self doesn't have to be convinced to step across at that point. It naturally and effortlessly does so once the evidence is revealed, or the situation is revealed. This one is really limited. I usually live in this limited one, but once I see this other possibility, we don't have to convince it. Let's try to shift my identity to the big one. When we're talking about it, it all sounds contrived, right? But I think we really can access those spaces. We naturally move to the bigger one. The bigger one is so much more free. Let me just finish this part. We naturally and effortlessly, or not, you know, we, or the sense of identity naturally and effortlessly shifts once the evidence is revealed, the evidence of the distinction between them. It may be that all so-called decisions are like this. In the end, the mind just goes with whatever makes the most sense. For this shift of identity to occur, however, it's necessary to actually be in touch with this awareness, to be in it, to be verifying the boundlessness, the space of awareness. Otherwise, it becomes just the limited, illusory self trying to convince itself to change identity, which is not authentic and it doesn't actually work. So when we're talking about it, it seems like, that sounds good. I'm convinced that I just shift my limited one to the big, to the unlimited one. But it's like, that's just some idea, right? Yeah. But once we can taste the differences experientially more, then when we're in touch with that, the sense of identity, I would say, like, naturally shifts to the biggest version of self possible.
I really like using the word threshold because it reminds me of the experience in Zazen sometimes where the identification is inside the skull, mm-hmm. and then that choice happens. Mm-hmm. And it's like a little threshold. It just goes to the outside mm-hmm. of the skull. And as soon as the outside of the skull, then it just goes.
Mm-hmm.
So that distance between being on the inside of the skull and the outside mm-hmm. of the skull is extremely small distance.
A hair's breadth deviation. Mm-hmm. That's nice, yeah. Inside or outside the skull. And I think that's a nice way of talking because it feels like inside the skull. And then what we're really talking about as this true self, it feels like the shift from inside to outside. But truly, I think what we can say is it's not inside or outside. It's completely unlocated. It's not a spatially located self. And therefore, that it's all-inclusive. Yeah, thanks for that. Yes, Rose.
This resonates very strongly for me, and it's been my experience recently that there's a very high correlation between those two levels of identity. They correlate with frequency that one is operating within, and at certain frequencies, there's not even a choice to be made. You just simply are always, as long as you're at that frequency, identifying with, assuming you have the intellectual understanding of it to begin with, the bigger version of self. But if something happens to bring one's frequency down, significantly down, the true embodiment of that goes away.
Yes.
Just as easily as it came.
It sure does.
Intellectual understanding that does you no good whatsoever.
Yeah. It might do the slight good of reminding us right. to practice it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right. It's not a one-time thing, right? It's But the more and more we can become flexible and confirm in our own experience these different types of self, the more we can like then cultivate and train it again and again and again. Another thought that comes up here is like, so sometimes when we're talking about it, it might seem like, yeah, this, the limited self, it seems like it's identified with the body and the five skandhas, makes this shift to the big all-inclusive self. Might sound as if it's like, then like, there's no more body or anything, we're just like space. But I would say, no, there's all the sensations of the body and all the five skandhas are operating, but from a different perspective, right? It's like, the identification shifts, from I am only the five aggregates, and this limited bodily self, to the all-inclusive self in which the body with all its stuff and all our habits of the skandhas are all happening too, but it's a larger sense of self. I think Neti once used this term of like, expand our definition of self, which I thought is a nice one. We could talk about it like this, like our definitions usually seems limited, and through this kind of, you know, experiential practice, we can come to see and feel this larger sense of self. And now it's like, so to begin with, we can say my identity is like is the body and thoughts and feeling self. And then the shift happens, the identity steps across the threshold, and now I am the awareness in which the five skandhas, body, feeling, thoughts, self, appears. So I still include them, but the problem is not so much that I'm identified with the body and thoughts. The problem is that I'm only identified with this body and these thoughts and feelings. Now I'm still identified with this body and thoughts and feelings, but also with your body and thoughts. Maybe I don't know your thoughts, but I'm identified with all the entire universe, including this body.
But even that can be just an intellectual identity.
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 And maybe the way to kind of check is, one sort of way we can sort of examine this is, if I'm in the space of all inclusive awareness, do I feel as if, this body and mind is more me than, that body and mind? And it's such a deep habit to feel like this is a little bit more me than Russ's body. This body's a little bit more me than Russ's body. I think if we're really, my understanding is that if we're really, in the experiencing of this true awareness, your body as it appears to these eyes, you know, and experienced through this causal series is equally me. In other words, of course you have different thoughts and feelings, I don't know them. You're a different causal series, but my identity is equally Kokyo and Russ. My identity. It's a weird way of thinking, right? But I think we can come to kind of check that. I feel like, yes, I feel very connected to Russ but I still feel like I'm a little bit more Kokyo's body than Russ's body. A little bit more. That's conventionally, of course, that's true. But ultimately, I'd say it's not really true, right? And, of course, the implications of this kind of thing are, like, hard to live that, right?
Particularly with our cultures the way they are right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Culture based on separation and greed, hate, and delusion, based on the separate selves. From this perspective, Donald Trump is equally me as Kokyo and Russ. My true identity is Donald Trump and Kokyo equally. Again, I don't see through his eyes, but that appearance of Donald Trump is equally me as the appearance of this body of mine. I think that's a key thing too, is that this body of mine is just an appearance in awareness, and Donald Trump is an appearance in awareness. And from like the perspective of the mirror, all appearances are, all reflections on the mirror are equally the mirror. It's not like some appearances are more like the mirror than other appearances, right? So it's a radical shift. Yes.
Well, I think somehow we intuit the truth of that. I think all people intuit the truth of that. And I'm thinking of when people actually demonstrate it, like when the suffragettes gave up their lives for other women, or when monks self-immolate for their country, or people go on hunger strikes. That's when they're demonstrating that their definition of self is expanded to equally to the extent that they'll let their own appearance of body go.
Yeah.
And people get extremely motivated by that. And I think it's because we know it's true.
Yes, and I think that's right. From a Buddha nature perspective, this sutra is all about all beings have Buddha nature. So the intuition, of course, it must be there with everybody. Some people, the intuition is heavily obscured by many, many layers of habits and patterns of illusion, and some is less obscured. Yeah, the light can't be blocked. So, sutra says, we made it up to chapter 12 here, and chapter 12, I think it's really like if you look into this 1,000-page sutra, I think this chapter is kind of like the center of the Buddha nature teachings. It's a kind of highlight chapter, I think. So it's much longer than on this handout, but it's all about Buddha nature. And the chapter is called Tathagata Nature. So the layman, Kashyapa, this is not Mahakashyapa, the Zen ancestor, Kashyapa said to the Buddha, "World-honored one, is there any self in any of the 25 existences? Or not, any of the 25 realms of sentient beings." And I try to figure out what these 25 realms are. It's all through the sutra they talk about the 25 realms, but it's a pretty obscure Buddhist teaching. It seems to be one way of talking about what we call the three realms, the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm. In more detail, like there's all these different heaven realms and there's different hell realms and you can add them up. So I don't know exactly the 25, but I think the meaning is in these three realms of samsara. Sometimes we talk about the six realms of samsara, right? It's not just humans, but all realms of sentient beings, which we call samsara, that are born and die again and again in the realm of causal series. And 25 realms of causal series. Is there any self or not? I think it's trying to cover, could there be some really refined deva realm where there's a self? If it's not in the human realm. Anywhere is there a self? And you might recall, I think last week I mentioned in the Pali teachings that one time a monk asked the Buddha, is there a self or not? I think it only happens one time in the whole early canon, and the Buddha doesn't answer. Mostly the Buddha's saying, not making a kind of statement of there is or isn't a self, he's just saying, these five aggregates are not the true self. Mostly what the Buddha's saying.
This is Mahakashyapa?
No, it's a different Kashyapa. But this Kashyapa is one of the main characters in the Nirvana Sutra. So, is there any self or not? So here it's like, at the end of the Buddha's life now, someone asks him the same question. But instead of being silent, he says, oh good man, self is what Tathagata Garbha means. All sentient beings have Buddha nature, and this is the self. So you kind of, it's a, like a resounding yes, there is a self this time around. And here's where a lot of terms get equated. And you might have noticed on the last page of this handout, on the very bottom of page 6, I put equivalent terms in the Parinirvana Sutra. And I think it's one of the kind of trademark things in the sutra. It likes to make all these equivalencies. It's one of its things for true self particularly. And this kind of the ultimate gets named all these different things. And I won't read the whole list right now. But in this chapter 12, the Buddha's going to equate three terms, really important Buddhist terms in the Mahayana. Self, or Atman, here, is what heart of the thus come one means. So that's Tathagatagarbha. And then also he says, Buddha nature, Buddha Dhatu, is the self. So here he's equating Atman, true self, with Tathagatagarbha, with Buddha Dhatu. These are three equivalents in the sutra. Atman, really a, I think self is a good definition. Last time we talked about it, it's related to the German word Atem, which is like breathe. And it goes way, way back to like thousands of years BC, like way, way before Buddha in the Vedas, this term Atman was being used. Something about our true nature. People were concerned about this. Who are we? So, and then Tathagatagarbha is this new Mahayana term that appears in this Nirvana Sutra. It appears in the Lankavatara Sutra. It appears in the Srimaladevi Sutra and Sharangama Sutra and probably others. Tathagatagarbha Sutra. Yes.
Just on a geekazoid level, do you have an opinion as to whether this sutra was in fact the Buddha's teaching at the end of his life, or whether it's an apocryphal, subsequently, retrospectively inserted into the legend of the Buddha?
Well, we all, as we understand now, like, all sutras, including the Pali Canon and the oldest parts of the Pali Canon, we call the oldest, everything was oral tradition for centuries after the Buddha. Nothing was written down for centuries after the Buddha's life, but it was passed on orally. And then things started to get written down, and the Pali, what we call the Pali Canon, was several centuries later. And interestingly, around the same time, scholars are saying now, as I understand, the early Mahayana sutras, like early Prajnaparamita sutras, were also being written down. We usually think of Mahayana as later, but I think when they actually got written down was similar time. But Southeast Asia focused on this certain type of teachings, and then other areas of India started bringing out these Mahayana teachings. And so I see it all as like the true Buddha is somehow enabling the expression of these teachings. But when we say apocryphal, I think usually when they talk about apocryphal sutras these days, they mean that were not written in India. It's a little bit of a country bias.
Like, India was the first place.
Yeah, so all these Mahayana sutras, the classic ones, arose in India, and scholars now can tell from the types of language around what period they first appeared in writing. And then, like Sharangama Sutra, most scholars would say is apocryphal, meaning it was probably written in China. But the Lankavatara Sutra, we have Sanskrit fragments. It came from India, and then we have translations into both Chinese and Tibetan, but we've lost the full original Sanskrit. But interestingly, there's one book in the last few years, again like a 500-page book, just on the dating of the Parinirvana Sutra. Somebody was really obsessed with this. I think because this sutra is such an unusual new take on things, it was very important. It's an epic sutra. It was the it's the source of these Buddha nature teachings. And I think this particular scholar, the reason he wrote this book was his kind of thesis is he's trying to prove that this is the first Buddha nature teachings on this planet, the first Tathagatagarbha teachings. In the past, people said other ones came first.
Did he date this to India?
Yeah, India and around 200 to 300 Common Era is when the first, when it probably arose in writing or was discovered in writing on this planet. So that's some centuries after the Buddha, but that's early, that's before...
Close as a guess, right?
It's pretty close. I mean, it's a couple centuries after Prajnaparamita sutras, but it's, and it's probably after Nagarjuna, because it refers to types of thinking that Nagarjuna, but it's interestingly to me, this is before Asanga and Vasubandhu, which is the Yogacara tradition of mind only. That came later. So there's no reference to like the storehouse consciousness and the eight consciousnesses. So later, this Tathagatagarbha teaching got kind of melded and blended with Yogacara, mind-only teachings. The Lankavatara Sutra particularly is that melding, blending. And that was very important for Zen. They say Bodhidharma, only about one thing from India to China when he came was the Lankavatara Sutra. So here, Tathagatagarbha, Tathagata means the thus come one, the is a name for the Buddha, but the one coming from thusness. And Garbha is this interesting term that, womb is, there's various meanings just in Sanskrit apart from Buddhism. There's, like a lot of words have many meanings. It can mean womb, it can also mean like the heart or essence. Not the physical heart, but the heart of something. Like when we talk about the Heart Sutra, it's like the heart of Prajnaparamita. So like the heart or essence or pith of something, which is a little bit like womb and a little bit different. Some people translate it as embryo. I think it has that quality in Sanskrit. Embryo has a little different feeling because it's like a, it's, but it also, embryo develops into something. It changes over time. Whereas, if we say it's the womb of all Buddhas, the womb, it's like what gives rise to all Buddhas. But embryo is similar in there, like matrix is another translation. A little bit like womb. I think the matrix is can mean something like, that which, gives rise to something. I'm not sure exactly the definition of matrix. In Chinese, they translate it into the characters for like treasury or storehouse or mine, like a gold mine. So like zo, like in Shobogenzo, the treasury or the storehouse of a true dharma, they sometimes, like in this sutra, they translate it as Tathagatagarbha as nyo-rai-zo. The thus come storehouse, Nyorizo. And this is, if this is the first Tathagatagarbha teaching, and it was translated into Chinese early, also like 430, before Bodhidharma and people like that, the year 430, by Dharmakshema. That's nice, I think, to know that Garbha can have this sort of womb and embryo and gold mine have a have the quality of a kind of something that gives rise to a Buddha or gives rise to a Tathagata, right? Like a potentiality. They have a sense of potentiality. Whereas the heart or essence or pith of something is not so much the potentiality, it's like the essence, the true essence or nature, something like the true nature of all beings. Not as a potentiality, but more like who they actually are. So both of those qualities are in there in this dynamic term, Garbha. And Buddha nature, it looks like it's referring to this Sanskrit Buddha Dhatu, and Dhatu means like element, I think in this case would be the best way, the awakened element in beings, or maybe realm. It's not really nature. So really this translator, Dharmakshema, in 430, was the first to coin this term, Busho. In Chinese, Japanese we say Busho, Buddha nature. And so in East Asia, and China and Japan and Korea, Buddha nature became like one of the most important teachings ever. And they always call it Buddha nature, so much so that now even like Tibetan teachings about Tathagatagarbha call it Buddha nature. But it's really coming from the Chinese term. Buddha element is a little bit clunky sounding. Buddha nature's great, I think. The awakened nature of all beings. And it also has the quality of potentiality, as we'll see in the sutra. So these three terms are equated. And then Buddha says, all sentient beings have, or as I mentioned the other day, I put have / are here, because that's Dogen's interpretation of this phrase from the Nirvana Sutra. All beings are Buddha nature. And it's legitimate to translate shitsu-u as completely are Buddha nature. We don't have the original Sanskrit for that phrase, which would be like, that's when you hear about this, sometimes in the sutras they say, some bodhisattva was willing to like give his life just for one phrase from a sutra. I'd almost be willing to give my life for that phrase in Sanskrit. So the Buddha goes on, such self, so all beings have Buddha nature, and this is precisely the Atman, the self. Such self has from the very beginning been covered by innumerable defilements, klesha. Klesha, you know, is like greed, hate, and delusion. Right? And just dualistic thought and dualistic perception even. The fact that I really feel as if like Russ is over there 20 feet away from me. That's a kind of subtle klesha. And that obscures, it covers Buddha nature.
Is it a question?
Yes.
I have a couple of questions about this line that have bothered me for decades. Anyway, are you aware of any kind of an origin, one or more origin stories about greed, hate, and delusion? Or, I mean, it's all just like, it's beginning with. Are you aware of any type of origin stories about like why?
Why?
It's existing.
Yeah.
How that comes to be. Or is it just one of these dictates?
It seems like just part of the situation, and it might be like that kind of question that the Buddha sometimes might say, like, you know, don't ask where the arrow came from, just pull it out, right? But yeah, there's one, as far as like, you know, a lot of religions have like a creation myth, right? There's this one interesting Pali Sutta, and in the long discourses, but I can't remember what it's called. Maybe Rick knows this. There's where the Buddha tells this, almost like it's like a parable story of kind of like the history of the world. And I can't remember the details, but it's like, it's kind of a little bit like the Adam and Eve story. My memory is like, it's like first there was this realm of these like happy beings where everyone loved each other, and everything was plentiful and full. And then I forget exactly the starting point, but something like the whole surface of the earth was like food, so you could just like reach down and eat it whenever you wanted. And at some point, I think the surface started changing or something, became less available, something like this. And as soon as this happened, this realm of like infinite abundance shifted, and the first people started like, actually, I need that, and like, that's mine. And then, but it describes it very beautifully as like, very gradually, just the little bits of duality, and then it gets greater and greater, and the greater, like, you know, harmful karma of beings, like, affects the whole world, and gets everything gets worse and worse up to the present day. So it's a little, yeah, it's a little like a creation story, but even then I can't remember, it was almost like by chance or something, that something shifted. But I think it's true.
In reality itself.
Yeah, I don't know if it was one of the minds of the sentient beings, but yeah, I think maybe it's safest to say we don't know. It's beginningless, and but we have to deal with it.
And what is your take on these innumerable defilements, even though you know they have power and they're substantial,
They appear.
They appear. How could something like that, in this translation, cover?
That's right. No, that's a perfect. That's a great question. I would understand it as that actually these klesha don't really cover the true self, the Buddha nature, because they're part of it. And later in the sutra, it actually says. I think it even goes so far as to say the kleshas are themselves Buddha nature. I think the sutras will say. But they...
It seems like the only possible way to understand
Yes, I think that's right. But for practical purposes, as maybe a skillful means teaching, we could say, because greed, hate, and delusion seem to obscure our Buddha nature, and therefore we seem to really suffer because we've lost touch with who we are, then... we need to kind of find the Buddha nature. It's not really hidden, but seems to be hidden. And there's other teachings, actually quite a bit of teachings in the sutra about this hiddenness and like the secret storehouse. And I brought this up on a Wednesday night recently, right? That one of the Zen stories is as one of the Zen, our Zen ancestors and our lineage, is quoting the sutra and says something like, the Tathagata spoke with a hidden meaning, and it's in this whole section about the secret storehouse, but Kashyapa did not conceal it. This Kashyapa. And when one of our ancestors heard that, he just started crying and like, why haven't I ever heard this before? And that was his kind of awakening. So something like, it's what seems to be hidden and secret only seems to be, yeah. So we might even say, such self has from the very beginning seemed to be covered by innumerable klesha, and that is why beings cannot see it. And isn't this true in our own experience? Even if we get in touch with, oh yes, no, it really is like there's this awareness in which everything's happening. I feel like I see it, it's clear. But then somebody insults us again, and the kleshas arise. And don't the kleshas seem to obscure it immediately again? We know, when we get back in touch with it, we can say, I know it was, it didn't go anywhere. My true nature, my Buddha nature was there, but I really lost touch with it. That's what we mean by obscure or cover. It seems to be covered all day long, especially by these subtle places like dualistic consciousness that perceives external objects. That is like all day long obscuring our non-dual, all-inclusive awareness. So Buddha says, imagine there's a poor woman. She has true gold concealed in her house, but none of the people of her house, whether children or adults, know of it. But a stranger who knows about gold arrives, and through expedient means, upaya, says to the poor woman, I'd like to employ you. You can do some weeding for me. And the woman says, I can't do this now. If you let my son see where the gold is hidden, then I'll work for you. And I don't know exactly why there's this thing, what this thing about employment is about in the parable. Maybe I might guess that it's like a metaphor for I can't practice like weeding until I know that there's Buddha nature or gold. Otherwise, why would I bother? Maybe something like that. But it's a little bit funny. Maybe something's lost in translation. But the gist, I think the important point, is that there's this poor woman in a poor family who has gold in her house, but she doesn't know where it is. It's hidden. I don't know where it is. And this person says, I know where it is. I'll point it out to your son. And the woman further says, nobody in my house, whether big or small, knows of this. How can you know about it? And the man says, I shall now make it clear. And the woman says, I wish to see it. Please let me see the gold. And the man digs out the gold that was hidden. The woman sees it, is gladdened, and begins to respect that person. And the Buddha says, oh, good man, Kashyapa, this case is the same with Buddha nature, which sentient beings have. Nobody can see it. This is like the gold which the poor woman possessed and could not see. Oh, good man, I now let people see the Buddha nature that they already have or they already are, which is covered or hidden by defilements. This is like the poor woman who cannot see the gold, even though she possesses it. The Tathagata now reveals to all beings the garba of awakening, the storehouse, the treasury, the womb of awakening. I don't know if it would be Bodhigarbha in Sanskrit, which is called Buddha nature. When all beings see this, they're gladdened and will take refuge in the Tathagata. The good expedient means is the Tathagata. The poor woman is all innumerable sentient beings, and the casket of true gold is the Buddha nature. So that's the metaphor. Remember the milk medicine metaphor was the first, particularly about teaching why the Buddha teaches not self as good medicine before, so we really understand what is not self before we teach what is self. Here's this metaphor, and there's others about this hidden quality, and there's a lot of other, there's another metaphor in the sutra about this hidden medicine in the Himalayas that has one taste, one flavors, but when people eat it, they taste it as six different flavors, which is like a realm, a metaphor for Buddha nature, is one taste, but it appears as a taste of the six realms. And there's a metaphor of the jewel, like in the forehead of a wrestler, and when he's wrestling, somebody pushes the jewel into his forehead, and it gets lost, and eventually a doctor says, I think you have a jewel in your forehead. But he can't believe it. And then there's this, because of time, maybe we'll skip this whole next long metaphor, but it's another milk metaphor. As I mentioned, the milk seems all through the sutra to be a metaphor for Buddha nature. But maybe because in India, it really is like the substances of a cow are like still really sacred in Hinduism. And at that time, I think for ancient times, they have been. So this one's about milk in the mother's breast and the child wanting to drink it, but this child has a sickness. And the doctor says, the child shouldn't drink milk. Put some bitter substance on your nipple so the child won't want to drink your milk. And then when it's cured, then take the bitter substance off and the baby can drink again. That's the basic gist of almost the same as the milk medicine doctor story. Almost the same, but slightly different. You can read it on your own. So let's skip down to the nature of self and not self. This is middle of page 3. Nature of self and not self are not two distinct things. So this is, I think, an important point. We could say the nature of the true self and the teaching of all conditioned things are not self. Those are not contradictory. The nature that the unconditioned self, there is an unconditioned true self is not contradictory to all conditioned things are not self. Can you follow that? So the true Atman is not contradictory to the teaching of these things are anatman or not self. That's the way that they're not two distinct things. Where the true self is the same as no separate false self, is another way you could say it. This is what the hidden Tathagata Garbha refers to. This is what's praised by uncountable, innumerable, boundless numbers of Buddhas. For example, one sees geese flying far off in the sky and wonders if they're really geese or the sky. One looks carefully and sees them indistinctly. Bodhisattvas are also like this. They see but a small part of the nature of the Tathagata. How could Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas see it well? So I think it's pointing out that it's this subtle teaching, and even if we kind of, in a discussion like this, I get a kind of sense of it, even maybe like a glimpse of it, of this Buddha nature, but even for great bodhisattvas, it's like looking at distant geese in the sky, like, is that it? I think that's what this means. It's like it's a little bit indistinct. It's like it's so subtle and so contradictory to our usual dualistic perception that it's indistinct even for bodhisattvas, not to mention Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas who never even heard about this true self teaching. It's the same with Shravakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, and bodhisattvas. All of them can arrive at the same Buddha nature. Why? Because the defilements, the klesha, have been done away with. Done away with, maybe we could mean like greed, hate, and delusion are seen as nothing other than Buddha nature itself, and therefore they no longer obscure it. Therefore, there's no energy to keep them going as greed, hate, and delusion. That would be one way to see done away with. Or just any way that we let go of greed, hate, and delusion, we start to open to Buddha nature. It's like removing the impurities from gold, like gold in ore. When you take the mud and the rock all away, you have the pure gold in the center. Hence, all sentient beings have the same Buddha nature. That's kind of implying the one. And later it actually says one. One first hears of the hidden Tathagata Garbha and later attains Buddhahood in the course of time, coming to know this fact. So then, the next chapter, 21, on pure actions. This is just an interesting one, I thought, that because it says love is Buddha nature. This is Maitri, which means love or loving kindness. And the way I would understand this is that love is like our shared being. Love is unity. Love is like non-separation. It's not so much like a feeling. Maybe a feeling of love comes from the fact that we're in touch with our shared being, with our unity of Buddha nature. This unity of Buddha nature that we share is covered by dualistic perception of self and other, and that's when we don't feel love. And this is love in the more like ultimate sense, as I would understand the reality of love. It is the reality of non-separation, our shared Buddha nature. And then loving kindness, which we can translate Maitri, I think, either way, as the reality of love and also the action of being kind, loving kindness, and that action of kind expressions to others is the way that the true love is expressed. You can say the reality of love is expressed as loving kindness, and both are Buddha nature. So this is the sutra here is goes on this long term of, again, this is where it gets into all these equivalents. So love is Buddha nature of all sentient beings. This Buddha nature has long been covered over by defilements, which is why all beings are unable to see it, or you could say to experience that true love. Buddha nature is love. Love is the Tathagata. Oh, good man, love is the great sky. The great sky is love. Love is the Tathagata. Oh, good man, love is space. Akasha. Space is love. Love is the Tathagata. Oh, good man, love is the eternal. The eternal is the Dharma. Dharma is Sangha. Sangha is love. Love is the Tathagata. So I think, for me, I think it's Buddha as awakened, the awakened one, makes sense that is Buddha nature. Dharma, we could say in this case, is truth itself, or the teachings of reality. Sometimes Dharma is used for like reality. When we talk about the Dharmakaya, it's like some people translate the reality body of Buddha. So it's easy to see how that is Buddha nature. And Sangha, maybe it's just to make a list of all three treasures, but I would understand that. How would we understand that Sangha is Buddha nature? I would say Sangha is the community of practitioners, of sentient beings, of usually somewhat obscured sentient beings, Sangha. But the true nature of the Sangha is Buddha nature, right? Everybody in the Sangha, who they truly are, is Buddha nature. So I think it's talking about the sentient beings of Sangha. They are Buddha nature, therefore they are love. That's one way to hear all three treasures. Love is bliss. So it's going through these four qualities of permanence or eternal, bliss, true self, and pure. Jo Raku Gajo in Japanese. It's going through these gradually. Love is eternal. Eternal is Dharma. Dharma is Sangha. Sangha is love. Love is Tathagata. Love is bliss. Bliss is Dharma. Dharma is Sangha. Sangha is love. Love is Tathagata. Love is the pure. Pure is Dharma. Dharma is Sangha. Sangha is love. Love is the Tathagata. Love is the self. The self is Dharma. Dharma is the Sangha. The Sangha is love. Love is the Tathagata. Love is immortality, or the deathless. It's this Amrita in Sanskrit. Immortality is love. Love is Buddha nature. Buddha nature is Dharma. So he goes on like that for a while. Rhapsodizing, totally.
Can you say a little bit more about the translation of immortality?
Amrita. We translate, in Chinese they translate Amrita into sweet dew. So we have this chant for the hungry ghost, like the gate of sweet dew. It's really the gate of Amrita. And it's like, I think it has multiple meanings. Amrita is related to death. Amrita is like the deathless. So it's one of those words the Buddha used in the early teachings for kind of deathlessness. But then it's also kind of like these substances. It's like I think in the Gate of Sweet Dew, it's like elixir, which is like food of the gods, like ambrosia. Some people translate the Kanromana as ambrosia gate. So it's like food of gods, and it's like I think maybe pre-Buddhist idea of substances that when you ingest them, you become immortal. I think it has that quality too. But it also means like the realization of awakening. And deathless or immortality is a strong word, right? But that's what we're talking about. Eternal Buddha nature, by definition, then is immortal. It's the causal series seems to be born in this lifetime and then dies in this lifetime, and the causal series then continues through the cycle of birth and death endlessly. So the particular 7 billion causal series are mortal sentient beings, but their true nature is unchanging, immortal, eternal Buddha nature, which again is like early teachings of Buddhism. You never hear stuff like that. But you do. But this word amrita, I think, is in the Pali Canon as a name for nirvana. Not to possess is the eternal bliss, self, and pure. When a bodhisattva, mahasattva sees Buddha nature, she realizes eternal bliss, self, and pure. Jo rakugara jo. Hence we say a bodhisattva has nothing to gain. So it's just a section about Buddha nature means nothing to gain. And I just thought it was interesting because Suzuki Roshi is so into this no-gaining idea. And I think the reason we could say Buddha nature is nothing to gain is because it's all-inclusive, right? There's nothing outside of it that it lacks. Therefore, there's nothing to gain. Having something to gain is the not-eternal, the not-bliss, the not-self, and the not-pure. Hence, we say a bodhisattva is a person with nothing to gain. Also, good man, that there is nothing to gain is emptiness or ultimate truth. When a bodhisattva, mahasattva meditates on the emptiness of ultimate truth, or the emptiness that is ultimate truth, he sees nothing. Hence we say a bodhisattva is a person who has nothing to gain. I think we say he sees no thing outside herself. When she meditates on emptiness or ultimate truth, she sees no thing separate from herself. Therefore, the bodhisattva is a person with nothing to gain. Whereas, and so the eternal, there's nothing to gain because there's no time in which to gain it. The pure, there's nothing to gain because it's perfectly pure. The true self, there's nothing to gain because it includes everything. And bliss, there's nothing to gain because there's no discontent. So that's the end of that chapter. We'll see how far we can get in one last class next week. I know there's a lot, and this is just a tiny summary of this huge sutra too. But I think collected the main Buddha nature points in this summary. All the positive aspirations and intentions and wholesome thoughts of the assembly today we offer to all sentient beings throughout space and time. May they realize their inherent, ever-present, all-pervading Buddha nature. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.